people are still showing up, that you could just get them here safely. And I just thank you so much for Lambert coming this morning and being able to share with us the Word of God. And I just pray that all distractions will just go away right now, God, and that we'll just be able to focus on you and learn something from your Word this morning, God. And I just thank you so much for everybody in this room, and I just pray all these things in your Son's name.
And good morning.
My name is
Ecclesiastes is in the Old Testament. It is a very much misunderstood book, and it's absolutely incredible book. It's about all the things in life that don't work and why they don't work.
Well, why do you say it's misunderstood?
We said, oh, most people take this book as a book of futility, and that life is empty, and that people take it as a very depressing, hopeless book, which it isn't. And I mentioned last time that the author calls himself, in most English Bibles it's translated preacher. I don't know how, in verse 1 is it translated preacher in your Bible? That's not the right word. The word Koheleth does not mean preacher.
Koheleth.
It means searcher. The investigative reporter.
Do you spell it? How do you spell it? Yeah.
That's what it actually is. This is the diary of King Solomon, of his investigation into the meaning of life during a time in his life when he was not paying attention to God, and he was king in Jerusalem and had plenty of money and time and resources, and he decided that he was going to make a thorough, systematic exploration of every area of life and see what made sense. He's the wisest man in the ancient world by far, as it says back in the Book of Kings, and the richest man in the ancient world. And we read last time the story of the account of the Queen of Sheba coming to visit him because of his fame was so far, so widely known that she came all the way up from Saudi Arabia to visit him and ask him hard questions. He built the temple in Jerusalem and dedicated it, and it was lined with gold and silver, vast tons of gold and silver. And when he dedicated the temple, that we have in the Book of Kings, a magnificent prayer of dedication that shows that his initial relationship with God was strong and fervent and wholehearted. But then we find that he began to get some girlfriends. He decided to marry Pharaoh's daughters. In the ancient times, it wasn't unusual for a king to marry the daughter of a foreign king to make it an alliance, to sort of cement relations, which the Jews were not supposed to do, and especially you don't really need 700 wives, which Solomon ended up with, and 300 girlfriends, concubines, and every time he would marry one of these wives, he would build a house for them, and they would come and bring their idols and their gods into Jerusalem, which was clearly a violation of the law of Moses. And over the course of time, his wives drew his heart away from the Lord, his devotion to the Lord, which is pretty understated, I think. So there's a long season in his life in which God's not on his mind. He's not praying to God. He's not looking to God. But he's rationally looking at everything in life. And he tells us what he's discovered. And so that's why the book begins. It begins with the summary, vanity of vanity, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. The word vanity means emptiness or purposelessness or nothing useful is going to come out of this life. This is existential despair, like a lot of people have today. It's kind of, life is utterly meaningless, woe is me. Why am I here? I wish I'd never been born. What does it profit a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? What is the meaning of life? Life requires a lot out of you, and hard work and pressure and suffering, and where does it lead you? So that's kind of his his introduction to the whole, to his investigation. Then in chapter 1 we looked at the cycles in nature. He looks at the rainfall and the seasons, and he notices that the rivers flow into the sea and the oceans never filled up, and there's a cycle going on in nature, and the cycles of nature go on quite independently of human beings, and the mountains last forever, and nature is permanent, but man is transitory. And that seems kind of strange. You'd think that man would be more important than the hills and rivers and oceans and streams, but he says, no, it's the other way around. Man is only here on this planet for a little while, but nature continues apparently endlessly. So that's the first thing that he notices as he's looking at life. In verse 12 of chapter 1, he says he sets his heart by wisdom concerning everything under the heaven which God gives to the sons of Adam to do. In other words, he notices that life makes certain demands on you. You got to get a job, or you'll go hungry. You've got to eat, you've got to sleep, you've got to have clothes, you've got to do something with your life. You don't just sit around. But in the end, no matter what a human being puts himself to, it's empty, it's futile, it seems to be futile. What is crooked cannot be made straight, what is lacking cannot be numbered, verse 15. He points out right from the start that this is not a reckless pell-mell abandonment to life, that he's going to go systematically into every area that he can think of and analyze it and take notes and study it, so it's not like he's just throwing himself into wild living because he stops and he's thoughtful all the whole time. Verse 18, in much wisdom is much grief, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. So when you go about the process of learning and studying and analyzing and seeing what others have to say about life, the more you know, the more hopeless life can be. You see, nobody else has any answers either. So he found that there was a certain grief and sorrow in accumulating all this knowledge and wisdom, because it only increased his own dilemmas. In other words, there's something to be said for a simple life that's not all cluttered up with a whole bunch of problems that you can't solve that are from all over the world. So that's chapter 1. In chapter 2, he decides that he's going to live the good life, and he's going to go on a systematic search for pleasure, and he's going to study laughter as a phenomenon in itself. He thinks it's great that people should laugh, but he points out that if you get into a long fit of laughing, your sides will split and you'll get tired, and that it's okay to have a good laugh, but there's nothing left over when you're through laughing. It's transitory. It doesn't have any net effect. And he wanted to study madness. What's it like to be mad or insane or be out of your mind? What's that like as the experience that human beings go through? And what can you get out of life by having all the sex you want to have, because he had 700 wives and 300 girlfriends, and all the parties that you could possibly have? And in 1 Kings, this is the richest man in the ancient world. This guy has got resources, and when he throws a party, 1 Kings tells us what the menu is every day. Solomon's daily provisions were 30 cores of fine flour. That's 10 bushels. A core is 10 bushels. So every day he needed 30 bushels of flour for making bread, and 60 bushels of grain of various sorts. That would be barley and corn and so on. And he needed, for his banqueting, 10 head of stall-fed cattle per day, and 20 head of pasture-fed cattle, from which you get prime grade A meat. And he needed, in addition, 100 sheep and goats, deer, gazelles, roebucks, and choice fowl. That would be chickens and ducks and all kinds of exotic birds. That's one day's food supply for this king to entertain 10 or 20,000 people in his palace. So he throws a party. It's just unbelievable by any kind of standards that we would even think about today. You can imagine the chefs you can imagine the delicacies and the setting this kind of a table up. Just amazing. By the way, I was going to read last week too. I mentioned that we don't know very much about this time in Solomon's life from the Bible, but the Targums of the Jews are certain writings the Jews left behind that are more or less in Jewish tradition, Jewish legend. And there is a Targum of the Jews which talks about King Solomon. And it says this: when King Solomon was sitting upon the throne of his kingdom, his heart became greatly elated with riches, and he transgressed the command of the word of God, and he gathered many houses and chariots and riders, and he amassed much gold and silver, and he married wives from foreign nations, whereupon the anger of the Lord was kindled against him. And the Lord sent to him Ashmodai, the king of the demons, and he drove him from the throne of his kingdom and took away the ring from his hand in order that he should roam and wander about in the world to reprove it. And he went about the provincial towns and cities in the land of Israel, weeping and lamenting and saying, I am Kohelet, whose name was formerly called Solomon, who was king over Israel and Jerusalem.
What's Kohelet mean?
Kohelet. Q-O-H-E-L-E-T-H. Kohelet. Now, that you can't trust that as inspired, but it acknowledges that there was a season in his life when he lost track of God. I don't think he ceased being king, as it's suggested here, but he may have wandered around the cities and towns. He might have disguised himself as an ordinary citizen in order to run around and meet people and explore and learn in disguise. That's possible. But anyway, he's going to spend some years in this process. So chapter 2 is this partying stage of throwing banquets and lavish parties and entertaining and having fine wine. And how is that? Well, afterwards you got to clean up the dishes. And afterwards you're full and you just go to sleep. And what's the net gain of all that? Well, there isn't any. Then he decided to go into horticulture, so he made the greatest and magnificent of ancient gardens and imported fruit trees and flowers and plants and orchards. And he had gardeners and servants so that he could have the most lavish, beautiful orchards and garden anywhere. And he even built conduits to bring water down from Bethlehem and pools to irrigate the garden, so that here was this magnificent garden, which he enjoyed gardening. Obviously, I don't know if you've been to the San Jose Rose Garden, example of a magnificently beautiful public garden. Well, he would have had a garden 10 or 100 times bigger than that, obviously. And he had slaves and servants raised in his own household to take care of things. So he could wander around in the garden and take interest in things, but he didn't have to do a lot of the work. He gathered male and female singers and musical instruments. So he put together orchestras and chamber music, and he had dancers, exotic dancers come in, probably Nubian dancers and Egyptian belly dancers and artists, the way they do at the White House. He got all the leading entertainers in the land to come in at state dinners and entertain everybody. And verse 9 of chapter 2, he became great, and he excelled more than all the other kings before him. And during his time, his wisdom remained with him. Then in spite of being king and having this honor and prestige of being king, he didn't shut off his analytical investigating, why am I here, what's life all about thing. What my eyes desired, I didn't keep from them. I didn't withhold myself from any pleasure. He could buy anything. He didn't hold back at all when it came to trying something new that somebody suggested. the end result of all that, the end result in chapter 2 there so far is nothing good came out of all this. All of this proved in itself to be empty. Nothing really was permanently satisfying. Nothing really clicked. I lived the good life up to the hilt more than most people live the good life. There's really nothing to it after all. In verse 12, he says how foolish it is to hunt after wisdom all for its own ends. If you were just going to be a wise man and sit on a rock on a high cliff in India someplace or other, what good would that do you? Just to be wise and have nothing else going. It would be of no use. It would do you no real good. Then he notices that whether you're wise or whether you're foolish doesn't much matter in the long run because you're both going to die. The wise men die and fools die, rich people die, poor people die, so that life has a way of leveling everybody out at the end. And so it seems like life is absolutely senseless. All you do is you see people trying one thing or another and they all lead to nothingness. In verse 17 he says, I came to the point where I hated the work that was before me under the sun. Everything that I was in was vain and grasping after the wind. I hated all the hard work that I put into my orchards and my banquets and my partying. And I came to this point of nothing worse, of despair. And not only that, no matter how much wisdom I put together, how much wealth I put together, I'm going to die and leave my whole inheritance to somebody else. And the person who inherits it may not appreciate it, probably won't, may squander it and waste it. All the things that were precious to me, I'm going to leave behind. And so all of life is grievous if all you do is build up your own little empire and your nice house and family, and then you die. That's the idea. Now, so far, there's a lot of emptiness, gloom, and doom. But now the whole secret of the book is in the next two verses, which is where we stopped last week. The whole clue to unraveling this book. There is nothing good, inherently good for man. The translations are not very good here. There's nothing inherently good for man that he should eat and drink and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. Even doing the ordinary things about in life that you're supposed to do, eating and drinking and sleeping, are not inherently satisfying, even though they're the normal, natural things in life. This also I saw was from the hand of God. Who can eat or who can have enjoyment more than I? If there's anybody that knows how to maximize pleasure and enjoyment, I did, and it didn't work. So I don't think there's anybody that can outdo me in my search for pleasure. Now, verse 26. If you get verse 26, you'll get the whole book. For God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight. When a man pleases God, he gives to that man three things: wisdom, joy, and knowledge. But to the sinner he gives the work of gathering and collecting, that the sinner may give to him who is good in the eyes of God. This is vanity and grasping after the wind. In other words, contentment in life is a gift from God. Happiness is a gift from God. Real knowledge and real insight and the ability to enjoy life are a gift from God. No matter how hard you look for happiness, it will always elude you. No matter how much you want contentment or joy or how much you want to get something out of life, it will always elude you unless God, in his pleasure, gives it to you. And who does God give joy and happiness to? He gives it to people who please him, to the righteous. Well, that's pretty awesome. Because it says right offhand that if you live in a relationship with Jesus and you are living any kind of a life that pleases him, he will automatically give you wisdom and joy and knowledge and contentment. Doesn't matter if you're digging ditches or if you're in jail or if you're the king or you're the president of the university or the head of the Bank of America. It doesn't matter what you're doing. if you're in the right relationship with God, you will have that contentment that eluded you. See that now? Life is going to be futile and vain in every area if you have left God out of the equation. So now look at how foolish the world is. Look at all the people around you who are striving for happiness or looking for love or just, I'm going to be happy as soon as I get my new car, or I can't wait till our new home is finished up in the hills. Or this person that I'm going to marry, I know that's going to make life much, much better. Or wait till I get out of school. All those things. The whole world is driven for this. Is driven by this elusive something. And it's always going to elude them if Jesus is not brought into the equation. Now, there's no area of life where you cannot enjoy contentment and peace if God is with you. You should be content, like Brother Lawrence, cleaning the dishes in the kitchen and be fulfilled and happy. And God delights to give people knowledge, which would be real insight into life, so that you see behind the scenes, and real wisdom, and then joy and delight. And those are gifts from God. And by God's grace. So that sort of says, now this turns the whole picture around. Now it says, all of life is meaningful. Everything you do is meaningful if you have brought Jesus with you into what you're doing. And if you have decided to leave Jesus out of what you're doing, what can you expect? You can expect that the end result of what you're doing is going to be futile. Not going to lead you anywhere. So that's this kind of little hidden secret about this book. And now you know the little secret about all the people around you that don't pay any attention to God. You know what's going to happen to where their lives are going. Because the wisest man in the world researched that for us. And here's his investigative report. And he's thorough. And he looks at all of life. Here we are. You didn't ask to be born here. We all showed up on the planet, didn't get to pick our parents. We didn't pick the time in history or anything. And most of the circumstances in our lives are out of our control. We're stuck with so many years to live out. We're stuck with school and work and the future and a certain limited period of time. And we don't have much to say about all that. That's true of all human beings. But now there's a little secret. If you're willing to let Jesus be part of what you're doing, then your life will take on richness and meaning and will be fulfilling. And all of this vanity stuff doesn't apply anymore. Now we get in chapter 3, we get a statement about the opposites in life. No matter what you would like life to have, what you would like to have happen to you today. Bad things happen. Life has seasons to it. He lists now 14 pairs of opposites here, which very roughly cover experiences that have to do with the body, physical experiences that have to do with the soul, and experiences that have to do with the spirit. And these famous quotes you've heard many times. To everything there is a season, a time for every purpose under heaven. When you're going through life, God has seasons for us. And events come to us out of the blue, and they're appropriate. When they happen to us, they're appropriate because they happen to everybody. There, for example, there's a time to be born. Well, thankfully there is, or you wouldn't be here. So there's a time when mothers bring babies into the world. If you are a parent, then you will be present at the birth of your son or your daughter. That'll be the most important thing going on. It'll be something you can take great joy in and great delight in, bringing a child into the world. And there's a time for that. Stop everything you're doing and rush to the hospital and watch this little child come into the world. There's a time for that. There's also a time to die. The other end of life. The life has a beginning, life has an end. You might live to be 90, you might not. People die suddenly and unexpectedly sometimes, and the phone rings and we have to stop and go to somebody's deathbed or go to a funeral. which usually means sadness and sorrow and grief and memories, and that's inescapable. And usually not something that we know about ahead of time. Sometimes you do. But, so he says that there's no way of getting around the fact that babies are born into the world and that old people die. Then the next thing he says in verse 2 is there's a time to plant and a time to pluck what is planted. Well, that's perfectly obvious. If you're a farmer, if you don't plant corn in the springtime, you're not going to harvest corn in the fall. If you don't invest in something right now, you're not going to reap down the road. That's the sowing and reaping are absolutely inevitable, right? Now the sowing part is hard work. If you're going to plow the field and plant the corn, that's a lot of hard work under the hot sun, and there's nothing to show for it for months. But if you don't go through that planting process, you're not going to have any harvest. Well, that's perfectly logical. Inescapable, unavoidable. If you don't go get a job and you don't work hard, you're not going to get a paycheck. In other words, life doesn't come free on a platter. There's a time to kill, a time to heal, a time to build up, and a time to break down. Time to kill, that's a little talking. Time to kill, a time to heal, time to break down, a time to build up.
Time to kill would be, say, warfare.
Warfare, all right. Sometimes war is in...
playing solitaire.
War is inevitable. War is a consequence of living in a fallen world. It's unavoidable. And it's tragic, and it's terrible, but it happens. There's a time for healing. You've had a terrible fight with your parents or with boyfriend, girlfriend. You've had a huge argument and bitterness and anger, and now it's time, that's all over, it's time to go make up. It's time for forgiveness and healing and restoration. That happens. Those things happen. Relationships get damaged and can be healed. There's a time to break down and a time to build up. There's a time that you change your lifestyle. And leave one set of friends behind and move to a new town, and there's a breaking down of a whole bunch of things that were part of your life for a while, and now you're going to build up something new. You're going to finish school, go off and get married, and build a home. There's the ending of one chapter in your life, and it's not always fun, but that's necessary. Time to weep, a time to laugh, a time to mourn, a time to dance, a time to cast away stones, a time to gather stones, a time to embrace, a time to refrain from embracing.
What's your reference to the stones? During reference to why you say a time to cast stones, a time to gather them? What's that referring to?
Well, in Israel, all the land in Israel is very rocky. And if you're gonna use the land, you've got to go clear the stones. And so every field that you're ever going to plow or plant crops in, it involves a great deal of go gathering stones and building little low walls. And
maybe just part of like the labor of life.
The labor of life. A lot of labor in life seems pointless. Why do I have to go through this futility? Why do I have to clean up my room? My room is perfectly fine, messy. The time to weep, it's obviously that there's times of sorrow and sadness. A friend is leaving you. Somebody has moved away. There's also times for laughing and having a great time. There's time for dancing and partying. They're perfectly legitimate. All these things are legitimate. They're not wrong in and of themselves. And they're going to all happen to all of us from time to time. There's a time to embrace, a time to refrain from embracing. Two people in love, falling in love for the first time, are caught up in the joy of an intimate new relationship, new marriage, and so there's embracing and there's affection, and there's a time also little children getting lots of affection from their parents, and then you grow up and the kids go away. And so there's less embracing. So those are the cycles of life. A time to gain, a time to lose, a time to keep, a time to throw away. There's a time to clean house and throw away, which I don't pay attention to. The time to keep. There's a time to go through your belongings and see what is important and keep it, and then throw out the stuff you don't use anymore. Give it to Goodwill. A time to tear, a time to sow, a time to keep silence, a time to speak, a time to love, a time to hate. That, relatively speaking, doesn't mean hate, hate, hate. It means a time to love passionately, a time to love less would be better. A time of war, a time of peace. Life has got these equations in it. Not every relationship is intense, white hot in its fervor. We've got casual friends. We've got deep friends. There's a time when the best thing to do is to say nothing. That's all these things are all part of normal human relationships in life. So, this is the world that we have to live in. This is the world this is what life throws at us. All of us, everybody. Nobody escapes these things. What profit has the worker from that in which he labored? I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of man are to be occupied. That's chapter 3, 9, and 10. God has made everything beautiful in its time, or really the word is appropriate. Sort of the summary. He looks at, is there value in life from doing the things that God has given you to do? Is there value in life from all of these experiences that we've just described? And they all come from God. And he says every one of them is appropriate in its own time. So sadness and sorrow are appropriate at times. Joy and merriment are appropriate at times. You don't want to go into a funeral and laugh uproariously. That wouldn't be the time for that. God has intended that life have this variety, have these seasons. They're all appropriate, and God gives them to all men. So there's nothing wrong with these things that life throws at you. It's how you receive them and manage them. Now, also, this is a real interesting verse. Also, he has put eternity into the hearts of men. Yet, so that no one can find out the work that God has done from the beginning to the end. Now, how about that? What do you think that means? God has put into our hearts eternity. And because of that, we can't find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. That's kind of a hard one to figure out. What do you think?
I think we're not going to be just contented with like the simple things of this world. Like he's kind of set himself on our hearts, and then we won't be satisfied with anything less.
That's right. So there is, all said and done, there's a longing for eternity, there's a longing for God, there's always this yearning for heaven, and the yearning to be with God is in our hearts, yes. And that's clearly one of the things here. What about this? Yet so that no one can find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. That's a curveball there.
It seems kind of like we don't really have like a concept of time.
We don't understand time very well. Neither do we understand history very well. life is full of mystery. No matter how much we analyze, dissect, take it apart, the past is hidden from us to a large extent, as is the future. And that's a very frustrating test because we want to have an accurate analytical knowledge of everything. Like to know the exact date of the creation of the universe. We'd like to know exactly everything that's happened in the past. And all those things are hidden from us, and God's hidden them.
Did you read about that giant, like, explosion in that galaxy, like, 400 light years away or something?
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
Yeah.
This morning or yesterday?
It was yesterday, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
They said it was, like, the biggest explosion they've ever seen, like, in the
Star
last 400 years or something.
When
like
did the
that.
Explosion actually occur? So it takes time to, like,
like, 400 years. I don't know. It's a long time. It says it happened, like, closer, like, 10 light years or closer to Earth, that, like, we would have all been, like, blown up. Like, entirely annihilated like that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So that would be something that you'd never be able to measure, anticipate, predict, until it happens.
Right, that star will happen.
So, there we have it.
The time to get vaporized by humans.
All right, so God put eternity in your heart. So this is the other thing about life. Life is not just the mundane. It's not just work, sleep, marrying, reading, studying, traveling, going places. There's an eternal part of us, the longing for eternity, the yearning for fulfillment that only God can answer. We are eternal creatures. He's talked about our mortality, but we're really destined for immortality. I know that there's nothing better for men than to rejoice and do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. Now, this is interesting. God would like to have everyone enjoy the fruit of his labor. God would like to have everybody enjoy eating and drinking and live a good life, no matter whether you're a poor person, no matter who you are. That God's gifts to men are the enjoyment of life. He lets non-Christians enjoy life. He lets non-Christians benefit from the rewards for their hard work. That's the kind of, God's not against pleasure. And he doesn't even mind the fact that non-Christians enjoy life. So life is good. Life is good. All said and done, life is good. Hard work is good. Eating and drinking and enjoying the fruits of your labor, all good. Worked hard and got an A on your midterm, that's good. All is good. Clean the weeds out of the back lot. It was hard work, that's good. Worked real hard pumping gas at the airport, and that's good. So there are little glimpses in here in which Solomon stops and sees that life has got all these things going on in it, but behind it is a good God who would like to have people find him, and he'd like to have people know him, and he really basically made us to enjoy life. And enjoy the ordinary things of life. We don't have to be ascetic. We don't have to starve ourselves. We're not more moral or more virtuous because we don't have a good time. Remember the difference between John the Baptist and Jesus and how they both got criticized. And Jesus said, John the Baptist came neither eating nor drinking, and they say he has a demon. The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say, behold, a wine bibber and a friend of tax collectors and sinners. Yet wisdom is justified by all her deeds. John the Baptist had this austere life of eating locusts and wild honey and living out in the desert and being very frugal. It's his lifestyle. And Jesus came along with a lifestyle of enjoying the company of being Pharisees and sinners and being going over to, for dinner and drinking wine and having a jolly time with all kinds of people, and people thought he was an absolute, totally dissipate person. So no matter how you cut it, nobody's, you know, people are never happy with the way God does things. So there's nothing to be said. Austerity in and of itself isn't good. Neither is living a good life inherently good. They're both, they're okay. It's all right. There are people that think that if they live a very lean life, they're living a better life, but not necessarily. So the thing about Ecclesiastes is that you have to look at all of life, and you can't judge life by the externals of how people are living, rich, poor, or the way they're living. You have to look at life as to where God is in what they're doing. That's going to be the secret of this book. So there's no one lifestyle that God likes better than any other lifestyle. Now, obviously, we're leaving out fornicating and getting drunk and robbing banks, and we're leaving out all those things from this. Obviously. Verse 14. I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing taken from it. God does it that men should fear before him. Now, eventually in life, you're going to run headlong into the sovereignty of God. You're going to run onto limits. If you decide to play God and you decide to run your own life, you're going to sometime or another come butt heads with the real God. Because the real God's in charge of the whole universe. And whatever he does lasts forever. And your little puny things that you do are not going to last forever. And his will is quite irresistible. And God's in charge of things, and he would like to have people fear him and stand in reverence and awe of him. We were that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. So the quicker we run onto the fact that God is sovereign, the quicker we understand that he's sovereign, that he's in charge of things and that we're not, and that we can't be God, and that we're servants. The quicker we realize that, then the better. Because that's very obvious here. You can't just go live life with no total disregard of God. So that's important. Nobody can do that. Nobody can get away with disregarding God forever. God does things this way so that men should fear before him, stand in awe and reverence and search for him. That which has already been and what is to be has already been, and God requires an account of what is past. What goes around comes around. Nothing new under the sun. Cycles repeat themselves. You can watch some young person headed down the wrong path in life, and you can tell them the road you're going on is going to lead you to ruin. And it's absolutely, totally predictable that if you keep drinking the way you're drinking, this is going to have a bad outcome. If you keep sleeping around all the time, where are you going to be? If you aren't going to go to your work and hold down a job, then where are you going to be in 10 years from now? Logical life, rules about life. God requires an account of what is past. Eventually, this is now. Life has got this freedom to it, but there's an accounting that comes sooner or later. Now, there's a problem with this that he needs to discuss, the problem of God's justice. And he says in verse 16, moreover, I saw under the sun, in the place of judgment, wickedness was there, and in the place of righteousness, iniquity was there. There ought to be justice in the world. There ought to be accountability. There ought to be honesty in the courts. You ought to be able to go get wrongs redressed and fixed. But very, very often when you go to the court, you've got corrupt lawyers or judges that don't know what they're doing, or bad laws on the books. So in practice, you would think there isn't any justice in the world. In fact, it seems like it's the opposite. God is very slow in judging people, so a lot of people think God doesn't care, or he's indifferent. He just told us that God requires an accounting of everything, and now he says, look at justice in the world and look at all the corruption in the whole process, all the injustice, all the wickedness in places where you'd expect to get an honest account. This is so true. If you know anybody that's gone through the divorce courts, or anybody that's been in any courts in the land, the bureaucracy, the corruption, the pain, the nightmare, because things are broken down, don't run well. When there's in the place that God, the courts should be God-appointed courts of justice, and they frequently aren't, and that's very sad. I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there will be a time there for every purpose and for every work. The answer is, yes, it's quite true that there is corruption and there's temporary injustice and wrongs are not righted, but wait around a long time. God is methodical in his justice. He just takes his time. And if you wait around, you're going to find that his justice is exact. Hi.
It's my friend Amador.
Amador. I've seen you forever.
Yeah. It's been quite a while.
Thank gosh.
Hi. I'll make it over there.
We're in Ecclesiastes too, way into Ecclesiastes. You can go do homework and read the first part. Chapter 3 talks about this. God is sovereign. God is in charge of everything. There is ultimately accountability to God, exacting accountability. God takes into account every single thing that everybody does, good or bad, and he keeps perfect books, so nobody gets away with nothing. But you have to wait a long time for God's justice, and in the meantime, there's plenty of injustice in the courts and in the legal system, and there's plenty of crookedness, and bad guys get away with doing bad things, and it looks like there's never going to be any justice, but wait a while, there will be. That's the whole idea. And it's to our advantage that God is slow in being just, because if you were to ask for justice today, what might happen? I'd get zapped. So God is God is 100% just, but he takes his time. Justice is a strange word. Judgment. Verse 17, I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked. There shall be a time there for every purpose and every work. That is, God has his days of judgment. He has his times of judgment. He has times of reward. Just because they don't fall into our time scale doesn't mean that they're not on his calendar. There is a day of judgment on his calendar. There are times when he steps in and fixes things. There are times when he intervenes. And when he intervenes, he generally is ruthless and thorough about it. And there's no way out of that. Nobody gets away with anything. I said in my heart, concerning the estate of the sons of men, God test them, that they themselves are but beasts, like beasts. In other words, Solomon has analyzed the behavior of human beings, the state of affairs of human beings, and he says God puts trials and tests into the lives of everybody, and what are you going to find out about yourself if you're really honest, and what is life going to force you to see about yourself if you really are honest? What What will life show you? That you're a beast. That you're a sinner. That you haven't got what it takes. That you're not nearly as good as you think you are. That, see, there's humor in this book. There's humor in this. Because human beings have such lofty opinions of themselves. And we think we're so great, and God looks down at us, and we're very puny. What happens to the sons of men happens to the beasts. Dogs die. Cats die. Cows and horses all die. So do human beings. So what's the difference? What happens to the sons of men happens to the beasts. One thing befalls them. As one dies, so dies the other. Surely they all have one breath. Man has no advantage over the beasts. Everything is vanity. Then once again, leave God out of your life. Exclude God from what you're doing. And you're really no different from an animal. And of course, sometimes we see people behaving very much like animals instead of like civilized people. All go to one place. All are made from the dust, all return to dust. Animals come out, are made out of the dust, and man is made out of the dust. And animals die and human beings die. Who knows that the spirit of the sons of men goes upward and the spirit of the beast goes down into the earth? If God didn't tell you and you didn't have any knowledge from God, how would you know whether your fate is to just disappear from history forever into oblivion? He buried the dead dog in the backyard, and that was the end of it. Maybe somebody will bury you in the backyard, and that'll be the end. And there's no future. See, again, leaving God out of this, you have no way of knowing what happens to you when you die. Right? The only way you're going to find out what happens to you when you die is if you put God into your equation, and you let God explain to you and give you wisdom and knowledge, then you'll see, oh, there's a tremendous difference between man and the animals. When Jesus is in my life, and I'm going on into eternity, and probably the animals too. But this isn't obvious from just looking at nature. Looking at nature, everybody dies.
All sharks.
So, I perceived that there's nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own works. That is his heritage. For who can bring him to see what will happen after him? Okay, this is kind of a hanging conclusion. He's summarizing so far. All the things he's done, he's kind of a summary. Summary of pleasure and the good life and learning and reading and studying and traveling and wisdom and knowledge and his thorough investigation of all of nature and our mortality. And there's the one conclusion here is there's not a lot that you can do about life and the circumstances of life, but you ought to enjoy it no matter what you're doing. There's nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own works. That's his heritage. Done a great job on the project. Be proud of that. Your boss commended you. Super. You got good grades. Fine. Enjoy. What are your hobbies? What do you like to do? You like paint, draw, sing? Are those the things enjoyable? Great. Enjoy them. That's your heritage. That's God's design. What does tomorrow hold? Well, I don't know. What does the future hold? So once again, he's saying, leave God out of the picture. If you weren't even to consider God at all, you might as well enjoy life and get the most out of it as you can. Well, that makes sense. Now, once you put God in the picture again, that turns it around totally. You see how this book works? He backs off. And he looks at everything in life from a natural standpoint. And that's this phrase, under the sun. Under the sun comes up again and again and again. Everything under the sun would mean everything in its natural appearance without taking God into account and this is what you conclude about life. This is what the philosopher, the intellectual, the searcher, the professor is going to tell you about life, the good life. You go get a lot of opinions about the good life. And Solomon tells you that, yes, that there is a good life. But happiness and joy and contentment and the inside secrets are going to elude you if God's not involved in what you're doing. Once you put God in the middle of what you're doing, everything is meaningful. Nothing is meaningless anymore. Nothing is futile. Nothing is empty. Everything is meaningful, no matter what it is. Going to the funeral, going to the wedding, going to the burying the dead dog in the backyard, going to that dreary job. All of those things are meaningful once God's in that, and they're all normal part of the cycle of life. So, now with God in your life, you can enjoy it up to the hilt, because it is meaningful. See, this book's about all of life. And the book says, let Jesus be part of all that you do. That's the whole idea. So you don't have to live a compartmentalized life. You don't have to block off one area of your life that where God's sort of off limits. And another area of your life that's your church life on Sunday where you become very religious. No. The book is about what Jesus said, I came that you might have life and have it more abundantly. Not religion, but life. So far, so good? Okay, that's the first three chapters. And we can pick up and go from there. This book is it's worth reading through and meditating on these things, because it is a book of wisdom, and as usual, it's poetic, and so if you stop and think a little bit about it, you generally can get several layers of meaning out of it. Okay? Our Father, thank you for our time together in Ecclesiastes. It's quite an amazing book, and we're kind of skimming the surface. And there's a lot here that it would be wonderful to understand more deeply, and it would be good if you could explain, bring verses to mind and help us to reflect on the insights that Solomon gave us 3,000 years ago from his own experience about life. And most of all, what's exciting here is that we have the opportunity of living a real, rich, full, abundant, exciting life. Not without pain and sorrow, and not without setbacks and trials and hard times, but nevertheless, a life under your grace and under your mercy is the best possible life. And set us free, Lord, if we try to shut you out of our corners of our lives. Help us to see that we're only just leaving that area of our life to emptiness and futility. So help us that we can embrace you in everything that we do. In the name of Jesus. I put this on my iPod. I take it home and it goes on my website if you want to.
You get it?
If you want extra credit.
I guess so.